You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. Welcome to the American Hour. We've got an exciting show tonight, as usual. Great guest, Eric Rush. We're going to have him on in just a second here, but I just want to tell you about next week. We've got Colonel James Harding. He's national spokesman for the Veteran Defenders of America. Very interesting group, and you don't want to miss that. But let's get right into our host, our guest, Eric Rush, because he doesn't have a lot of time with us. We're really thankful that he took the time to be on the show with us tonight. Eric, back in 2007, as a black conservative commentator, broke the story about then-Senator Barack Obama's ties to militant Chicago preacher Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Of course, we all know that story, and it was featured on Hannity based on a column that he published on February 20th of that month. He's also a contributor to social commentary, a variety of print and online publications, WorldNet Daily, Canada Free Press, The Washington Times. He's been on CNN and Fox, obviously, and a veteran of innumerable radio appearances. Eric, welcome aboard. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we've got some good stuff lined up to talk about tonight. Now, the one thing I didn't mention was you wrote a book back in 2007 that was the New York Book Festival winner of 2007, Negrophilia, From Slave Block to Pedestal, America's Racial Obsession. We'll get into that in a few minutes, but what I want to do to start this off is, here's how we start this off. Tell us where people can connect with you, whether it's social media, website, etc.
You can connect with me at ericrush.com. That's ericrush.com. And then you can also find me on Facebook. I've got a couple different profiles there and a fan page. And I'm also on Twitter. That would be Twitter, I guess, .com/ericrush, E-R-I-K-R-U-S-H.
All right. Yeah, I've been to your Facebook page and your website and seen you on Twitter, and you put some good stuff out there. Let's start it off this way. What do you think is the most important thing that people ought to know today about this presidential election? What's really got your interest today?
What's really got my interest today is that the campaign is really – you know, although they're doing their level best to continue to portray the facade that they have been portraying for the last, more than 4 years, because it goes back before the campaign of 08, it does seem to be crumbling behind the facade. I think the most evident example of that was the first debate, which was the presidential debate between Obama and Mitt Romney, and people actually got to see that what Obama was made of, really. The thing that really destroyed him in that debate is that he didn't know what he was talking about. Romney has the background in those domestic issues because he'd been a governor. He's not just a, and I was not a big Romney fan. He was not my first choice, just for the record. But he has so much background in terms of the, being able to fix things that are economically broken. And that, that's what he did in Massachusetts with their economy and turning that around. He just knew the subject matter back and front, and Obama being basically that chair that Clint Eastwood brought up at the convention, he didn't know, and it was very evident to millions of people. And I think a lot of folks, while they don't necessarily aren't necessarily aware of his core values, which are pretty scary, they at least know that the guy doesn't really know what he's doing from the point of view of the chief executive.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Now, isn't it sort of ironic and fate in a way that Clint Eastwood, just off the cuff at the last minute there at the Republican convention, decided to put a chair out there, or a stool actually, and talk to that stool, and then the whole empty chair thing came along, and then literally a month later, we get to see the real empty chair in action.
I know. That was really very ironic. It's somewhat amusing. A lot of people aren't familiar with that sort of style that Eastwood was using. It's something that they sort of teach people in, you know, people who are going to acting schools and things of that nature, but it's also a real big sort of a comedy routine in certain cultures where you talk to nothing, and it's sort of to insult someone, which Eastwood employed, but that, you know, folks were saying, or at least some of us back in 08, that he was an empty suit. Of course, that didn't catch on because everyone was just into that cult of personality, but we've really seen that empty suit or empty chair. Up close and personal during that debate. And, you know, I don't know how he's going to do damage control behind that, because even in the areas of foreign policy and other things that are coming up that one might say Romney doesn't have the experience in, per se, Obama's record in those areas is so abysmal, and his values are going to, you know, push him into that sort of fighting to reveal what his core values really are. You know, all he's going to be able to say is the canned sort of responses that he has, and he's not used to speaking extemporaneously, which is going to put him at another big advantage. You know, the whole teleprompter thing, I thought was funny, people saying, well, he should have been able to use his teleprompter. Well, you can't use a teleprompter in a debate. Yeah. I mean, because you can't have that much material set aside for some, and you can't have someone think for you.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, when he was running in 2008, I used to compare him to Ted Baxter, and if anybody remembers the old Mary Tyler Moore show.
Oh,
Ted,
yeah.
Baxter had a great voice and could, I can't think of the actor's name off the top of my head right now, but, you know, great actor, hilarious comedic actor. And Ted Knight. So sometimes they would insert something into the teleprompter that wasn't supposed to be there, and he'd just read it, and he wouldn't even realize what he had done. And so I used to tell people, that's what Obama is. He is a Ted Baxter. He can read a teleprompter with a nice voice and read it eloquently, but he's never speaking from the heart. And this is what I told people after the debate. The reason he did so poorly is he can't speak from the heart, because if he spoke from the heart, he'd be talking about redistribution and socialism, because that's what he really believes in. He can't talk about the things he really believes in, like a Mitt Romney, or we watch Rush Limbaugh. I mean, he always just talks. He can talk for an hour and a half in a presentation and never read anything off of any script, and certainly doesn't have a teleprompter. So that's really his problem. And so you've probably noticed a lot of articles in the last couple of days that are all predicting that Obama's going to do pretty close to equally as bad in the rest of the debates, because he has to be so careful about what he says. He can't just open up and start talking.
Absolutely. And case in point, as you said, you know, the few times he goes off script, he inevitably gets into trouble. However, you know, and it, again, it's a talent you can cultivate, but having that natural ability that he definitely does, you know, he's an actor. You put the script in front of him, he's very good at saying what his handlers believe the American people want to hear at that moment, and he can deliver it in a way that appears sincere, and that's what he's been doing. It's been harder and harder to do as things have gotten more and more dismal with regard to the economy and, you know, foreign affairs and everything, and so he's been put under more and more pressure, and of course now he's in a situation where people are scrutinizing him more judiciously than they were in 08 because he was an unknown quantity, and now they have this horrible record, and he's not getting as easy a ride as you've no doubt noticed. Even elements of the liberal press are starting to, not necessarily give him as easy a time, and it's killing him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now let's go back to 2007 when you broke that story about his ties to Reverend Wright, and not just his tie, but what that church was really about. Tell us how you stumbled on that, or how you found that, and what really stood out to you, and even to this day, what people need to know about his connection to Reverend Wright.
Well, I was alerted to that by a Chicago area journalist who knew of Obama and knew of the church. And I basically did a little bit of research and was appalled because it was basically one of these militant black churches that is based on what they call liberal theology, which is essentially a apostate Christianity that sort of injects a bunch of Marxism into it, sort of paints Christ as a rebel with a beret on and a black turtleneck and a machine gun, and that's sort of their attitude. And it's very anti-American, very anti-white, anti-Semitic, and so they're, I just looked at their sort of their creed statement, which was on the website. And it was, essentially racist. I mean, some people might say it was not in your face. It wasn't in your face racism. But I said, if you took out the word black and inserted white in here, and this was some sort of a white separatist or a white church out in the sticks someplace, people would be freaking out if there was a candidate for the nomination for party's nomination for president. And I basically wrote a column based around that, and it got picked up by Sean Hannity at the time, and he was with Hannity and Combs. And then Reverend Wright came on obviously we'll never forget. I came on February 28th, 2007. Reverend Wright was on the very next night, talking smack about me, of course, and it was really awesome because Wright chastised me and Sean Hannity and everyone else for, well, you haven't studied this. I'm a PhD and blah blah blah, and I studied all of these black liberation theology, and you should do that. And so we did, and everyone who did became more and more appalled, because if you study black liberation theology, it is very in-your-face racist. The fellow who invented it, James Cone, and a lot of the other preachers they make Jeremiah Wright look mild in terms of the racism that they espouse. So the more people who got educated on black liberation theology, the better it was in terms of informing conservatives across the board and other Americans into just how nasty and how dangerous this so-called religion or religious persuasion was.
Yeah, and I'm always very careful to criticize any religion, because there are always a lot of critics out there that spin things and don't really portray it. But I did the same thing as you. When you broke that story, I decided to dig into it. I got a hold of that book by James Cone, which Reverend Wright mentioned James Cone's name, and as if he was proud of the fact that, he's associated with James Cone. I think he was even to some degree a mentor of his when he was younger.
Yes.
The book is called Black Theology and Black Power. I carry this around with me on my iPad to show people, just to let them know that I'm just not making stuff up. But the doctrine states that all whites are collectively guilty. White oppressors must cease to be, not just stop being oppressors, but we need to, it's almost a genocidal sort of a cease to be, and equates white society to the Antichrist, calling white
a
symbol of depravity and the enemy of mankind. One of the quotes, page 3 of the book, I believe that all aspiring black intellectuals share the task that Leroy Jones has described for the black artist in America, to aid in the destruction of America as he knows it, page 23. And it should be said that racism is so embedded in the heart of American society that few, if any, whites can free themselves from it. So that's what I discovered, and I was appalled as well. I was absolutely appalled. I think that that whole concept, black liberation theology, is an abomination to Christianity.
Absolutely. As a Christian, I also try to cut people a certain amount of slack, you know, of other faiths. But, you know, it is biblical to make discernments of others, you know, other Christians' faith. And when you look at this, it's pretty horrible. And that is what Marxists have basically used to taint black Christianity and to sort of shepherd blacks away from, you know, what is mainstream Christianity into this sort of worldview that whites are genetically predisposed to oppress others, and that America is essentially evil, and it is part and parcel of what Barack Obama was raised believing to start with. So this was really a perfect venue for him to build his facade of being a Christian, so-called Christian American, unquote. It's all based in that same sort of anti-American Marxist worldview.
Yeah. All right, so here's what I've been wanting to do, and I want to talk to you a little bit about something that I call the new American racism. And I'm going to lay out, it's going to take me about a minute. I've got a bunch of bullets here to lay out from different things that I've observed happening recently that are, I find, disturbing, and I'd just like your comment on it, what you think about this. But again, I call it the new American racism. Actress Stacey Dash, who is a black actress, and I hate putting labels on people. You know, I'm American of Hispanic heritage, but I never call myself Hispanic, and I don't like calling people Hispanic or Hispanics or Latinos to describe them, because they're Americans. If they lived from somewhere else, then they're Argentinian or they're, you know, Cuban or whatever. But unfortunately, just to lay this out, I'm going to do this. So Stacey Dash is a black actress, and she put out on Twitter that she was supporting Romney, endorsing Romney. And the backlash she got, and I know you're aware of that, and people can go search that if they want to see that, but that happened just a few days ago. A couple weeks ago, I had Louis Farrakhan on a plane. I'm a captain with a prominent airline, and I was flying into Kingston, and he was on the airplane. And I always go back into business class and sit between a couple of the business class seats on the console and lean over the back of the seat that's facing me and say goodbye to the passengers. And Farrakhan was literally across the aisle from me. He was waiting for his bodyguards. They were sitting in coach. He had handlers with him up there in business, but he had some of his big guys who were back in coach to get up there to grab bags and then all get off. I was shocked to see how many people getting off the airplane were looking at him, smiling, waving, and, you know, wanting to get a photo. I'd say about 50% of the people getting off. And then here's sort of the kicker to this, and then I'll move on to the other incidents, but I just happened to need to call a friend of mine who is a very conservative black woman about some campaign stuff for some different campaigns going on up in Central Florida. And I mentioned to her, guess what, Farrakhan's on the airplane that I'm flying to Kingston. And her response was, oh, you should get an autograph or something like, you know, get a photo or, you know, go talk to him. And she could hear the silence on the other end of the phone and said, well, you know, I don't believe with any of his positions on almost anything. But, you know, he was around during the civil rights movement with Martin Luther and Malcolm X. And I didn't say anything, but I just thought to myself, there's something going on here when even a conservative, highly, highly conservative, you know, Republican activist says that. Okay, so next thing, 97% of blacks that actually voted in the last presidential election voted for Obama. You know, what would happen if 97% of whites had voted for McCain? But that's, you know, that's a fact. Ann Coulter just came out with a new book, and I think I've got it. She wrote an article for the Daily Caller, or they published it, and the title is Liberals Can't Break Their 200-Year Racism Habit. Now, it's an interesting book on how the Democrat Party has been the party of racism, the party of slavery, the party of segregation, and anti-civil rights movement. And so she put that book out. But it's interesting, a good friend of mine, Franz Cabreau, wrote a book called Stolen History. And I just saw on Facebook the other day that, and he's a guy who went from a journey from being a black Democrat to now a very staunch conservative. He decided to look into the history of the Democrat Party when as far as it you know, concerned blacks and slavery and civil rights, and he was shocked at what he found. And so he ended up writing a book. Well, the book now has been pulled from Amazon. The first 12 hours it was on Amazon and went to number 8 for political history. I even tried to download the page is still there for downloading it to Kindle, but you can't download it. It says not available. So I don't know what's going on there, but he's very popular with the Tea Party group. Then we've got Selwyn Duke, who wrote an article in American Thinker in response to Lloyd Marcus's article, and I'll get to that in a second. But he quoted Lloyd's father, and Lloyd had this in a previous article, where Lloyd had taken his father to a black conservative press conference. And here's the quote from his father. He said, "Everything I heard today is true. But because of the racism I suffered in my youth, I cannot turn against Obama." And then finally, I'll read to you the opening comment on October 5th of Lloyd Marcus's article in the American Thinker entitled "Obama's Poor Debate, the Affirmative Action President Exposed." He said, "If I were a part of the brain-dead racist herd of African-Americans who voted for Obama solely because he is black and celebrated him winning the presidency, I would feel pretty betrayed and embarrassed by his debate performance." And then he kind of goes on from there. But what's your take on all of this? I'm seeing sort of – it's not a reverse racism. I'm not talking about that, of blacks against whites. It's just sort of this idea that if somebody is black, they get a pass, like this president has, especially by the black community, on all the kinds of atrocities this president's committed and unlawful and unconstitutional acts – simply because he's black. And we're seeing, and then those people that stand up and say, "No, I'm not a part of that crowd. I believe in the Constitution and limited government," they're chastised by other blacks for not being black enough, or you know, selling out and that kind of thing. And this may tie into your book and what you wrote in your book. And so, tell me what your thoughts are on that.
It very much does tie into the book. I wrote the book it's to sort of enlighten people as to these things that are going on, and that racism is at the core of it. It isn't the kind of racism that you had, you know, supposedly the old segregationists, for example, but it's just this affinity and this deference that blacks and liberal whites pay to blacks just because they're black. And you know, you can't call it really reverse racism. It's racism. It's just of a different stripe. And it is intellectually dishonest, of course, and it's dangerous. You know, we should be learning that a black president can be every bit as much the scoundrel as a white president could. Of course, anyone with a brain essentially knew that to start with. Obama has, of course, proven that. And it just has to do with the liberal indoctrination that has gone on since the civil rights movement. I've said many times that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. has got to be, you know, he must have broken the sound barrier by now, spinning in his grave, because this sort of deference to blacks, which is what the title Negrophilia was all about, is what gives rise to things like people treating Louis Farrakhan with deference as a celebrity, despite the fact that the man is evil. It's craziness. And that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book, and reverse racism or black racism or whatever you would like to call it, which does extend to some extent to other minority groups, is really at the core of what the book was about.
Yeah. You know, I don't feel like there are any blacks that are you know, treating me poorly. I work with lots of them in the airline industry. And when I say that, I mean, I've worked with, actually flying out of South Florida, a lot of Americans of Hispanic heritage. But I don't feel like there's anything that's affecting me. Here's what I feel like is affecting me. When they vote based on the color of somebody's skin, like they did in the last election, that hurts me, that hurts you, it hurts the country. So nobody's
right.
picking on me. I don't feel like I'm not afraid to walk down the street or in certain neighborhoods. I don't. That doesn't concern me. But it's the choices they're making politically today that is hurting everybody. And it appears to be based on skin color.
Well, another thing I said in the book, and it was a point that I drove home pretty thoroughly, is that on a personal level, I think the majority of Americans really could care less about what ethnicity someone else is. It is really just the dedicated political ideologues that have a problem and perpetuate this kind of thing. But it is, once again, when you take it to the choices that people are making on a political level, you know, when they go to vote, yeah, I'm vote for Obama because, you know, I've been indoctrinated into believing that, you know, people of minority status are going to be more sensitive to certain things than some evil old white guy with gray hair in a suit. And
yeah.
That's what they've been raised to believe. That's what they see on the news every night. That's what their teachers have said. That's what, so it really has to do with indoctrination, and all of it goes back to essentially the political power that the left has aggregated, accumulated over the last 40 years. You know, the race angle, as you and I have been discussing, is really just a symptom of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got time to take one caller here, and I apologize to the caller because I wrote down Marty. And is that your name, Marty?
It is Morty, but that's close
Morty,
enough.
Okay. I started to think about it. Okay, Morty, you've got a question for Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, I did. And, hey, pleasure to meet you, sir. I wanted to ask
Likewise.
You what influence you thought, because the Communist Party did fairly heavy recruitment from the 20s onward in different stages, and I was wondering if you had any comments about in talking about Reverend Wright and other somewhat militant even religious figures, which you would think they would be opposed, but do you think there was an impression or a lingering impression of communist recruitment among blacks, both in the South and the North, that perhaps left its fingerprints on individuals like Wright and maybe Louis Farrakhan and other people who have a sort of a militant stance?
Definitely. While a lot of what went on in the civil rights movement was sort of catalyzed by Christians, the communists typically went after people who felt or they perceived as disaffected, and that definitely included blacks. You know, they determined back in the Jack Reed days, you know, back in the 20s and what have you, and prior to that, that, you know, America was too comfortable a society to generate a communist revolution. So they started with people that appeared to be disaffected people at the lower socioeconomic end, and of course that included some blue collar workers, minorities, blacks, of course. And that is sort of the thought that people like James Cone gravitated toward, and some of these professors that he wound up learning from, who were essentially Marxists of that old school variety, and it really just sort of flowered from there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Even as the party itself essentially lost much of any power that it had in the 60s and 70s, it seems like that attitude, which is blame America, America is the root of all evil, kind of transferred itself from the communists, activists, to people that sort of found a place in various churches and religious organizations, which seems like it would be a contradiction, as communism is adamantly anti-religion. But I don't know if Reverend Wright's church is necessarily a church in that sense. It's like a front of a church to kind of promote this anti-American ideology.
Yeah, and I don't think that a lot of them even see it as such. you know, as a lot of progressives don't really see that they're progressing, as it were, toward communism. But then there are people who, you know, who made a definite effort starting back in, you know, probably the 40s and 50s of saying, hey, you know, we're not going to get it coming out and saying that we're communists, so we're going to have to be a little bit more covert about it. And you know, those are the kinds of folks, the, you know, Obamas and the Bill Ayers and the David Axelrods and all of these people who essentially they hold all of these Marxist you know, convictions, yet you ask them, oh no, I'm a progressive, you know, well, that they just changed their modus operandi is all.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's like what's the quote to maul a quote by Shakespeare? You know, a communist by any name would still smell as badly.
There you go.
Yeah. Yep. All right, Morty. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate that.
Sure.
And you take care. Hang in there, Eric. Our time has run out. Would have loved to have you on for 2 hours. It's great talking to you, but I know you got to go. So really appreciate you coming on. Everybody out there, ericrush.com, and Eric spelled with a K, E-R-I-K. So ericrush.com. And, of course, on Twitter, follow him definitely on Twitter, at Eric Rush. And, again, thanks for all you're doing out there, Eric, to hold
Thank
up
you.
The conservative standard and support this nation for what it was founded to be, and that is a limited government, free society. Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right. Good night, Eric.
Good night. Take care.
All righty. Well, that went fast. I wish, you know, we had more time with it, but we got – more great guests coming, and it's only going to get better from here. I believe we may have Nick Taxia on the line. He's supposed to be calling in about now. Is that you, Nick?
It sure is. What's up?
All right. Welcome. Well, give me a minute here to talk about our guest next week, and then one other thing, and then we'll jump into the Nick Taxia segment. Of course, everybody knows progressive.com, fantastic website. It's hilarious, but it's also got some really good serious stuff there, including an article from, yes, me. But you do a great job, and there's so much great information on there, but it makes me laugh every time I go there. I read a couple of the headlines to my wife the other night, and we both laughed our butts off. Just hilarious. So in any case, we'll get to you in a minute, Nick. Colonel Jim Harding, he's the national spokesman for Veteran Defenders of America. And just so you know, he is one of the most highly decorated war heroes in our country's history, rated 24th for medals and recognition of bravery, et cetera. Great guy and a pilot also, so I like that. But here's the mission of the Veteran Defenders of America. The mission is to create a nationwide volunteer network of veterans who, through education, information, training, and preparedness, will serve as a key part of America's frontline grassroots eyes and ears of freedom with respect to threats to our national security and our freedoms, such as the threat of radical Islam. In other words, we all took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and bear true faith and allegiance to the same. Well, we can continue to do that. And they've got an organization put together so that we can continue to defend the Constitution of the United States of America, even though we may no longer be in the military, retired, et cetera. And so he's going to be a great guest. I've been told by my booking agent that he is a really good speaker, and you're not going to want to miss what he has to say and that kind of stuff. And then I want to just backtrack just for a second about Franz Gabreau, good friend of mine. Not a pilot, also a naval aviator, et cetera. I'm looking at the Amazon.com page just to download his book. First of all, I searched for Stolen History and his name, and nothing came up. He had a link on his Facebook page from just days ago that, hey, you can go here and download to your Kindle, and I wanted to download to my iPad the book. And it says, not currently available. It's not there. And yet, when he first posted it, I think within the first 12 hours, here we go. Here's what he posted. This was just 6 hours ago. Just 6 hours ago. He said, Stolen History just hit number 8 on the Amazon bestseller rank for political history and theory. It only took 12 hours. Thanks for spreading the word, blah, blah, blah. And then a few hours later, they pulled it. Is there a conspiracy here?
I don't know, but, you know, his book is, the whole focus of his book is that the Democrat Party is not what they say they are, that they've tried to rewrite history, that they are the party of racism, they are the party of segregation. They fought all the way along in history to oppose black liberty and the ability of blacks to vote, ability of blacks to, you know, be just like everybody else. So that's what his book is about, exposing them for what they are, and all of a sudden maybe somebody at Amazon figured out what the book really was, regardless of how many sales he had, and all of a sudden it's not there anymore. Then I saw on Facebook where Donna Harley wrote on Franz's page. She said that Timothy Egan, I don't know who that is, called Amazon to find out, hey, where's the book? And Amazon answered and said, we'd love to help you, but we can't find the item. So they can't find the item, even though it was selling hot for 12 hours. All of a sudden, they can't find it. It's just vaporized and went away. It disappeared. So you can definitely get it if you go to Franz's webpage, and if you just Google Franz Cabral. Of course, his name is not normal. If you just Google Stolen History, Franz, F-R-A-N-T-Z, you'll get to his website, and you can buy it directly from him there. And I don't think he has the download there, though, but it's sad. This is just sad. It's just ticking me off, and I don't know if you listened to the first part of the segment, but we talked about all of this sort of not quite reverse racism, but the choices, the political choices that blacks are making based on color, and I had a bunch of examples I cited, and, of course, that's really what our last guest's book is about, Negrophilia, Eric Rush, and you definitely want to follow him and see what he's putting out there. From his website and the articles that he's been writing for a bunch of different columnists. But in any case, okay, that takes care of that. Nick, my friend, how you been?
I'm all right. I'm a little bit agitated. Talking about banning things and taking things off the shelves and all that. Facebook has forbidden. I have several accounts on Facebook. Because, as you know, I have a team of writers for Dub Progressive, DUHProgressive.com, and some of them have their own Facebook accounts, one of them being pretty substantial, and Facebook has forbidden me from posting on anyone else's page from that account. So I'm a little irked at, while we're on the subject of things being banned and prevented and blocked, I'm a little irked because they say I'm a spammer. I don't know if somebody reported me or not. Unless I only reported one man on Facebook, and that was a guy who, or was actually a woman who threatened to physically harm a public official, and it was on a feed that I started. So I didn't want to be associated. I blocked her. I reported her. I didn't want to be associated with her. You know, you don't threaten public officials on my stuff. But that's the only person I've ever reported. Anybody else I didn't like, I just blocked. I don't know why. What's up with all this reporting? You know, Facebook is like, you know, the social media, Oceania. It's very it can be very Orwellian like that. So I'm irked, Tom. I'm officially irked.
I don't blame you. Well, how's the website doing?
The website is doing fine. This just happened today, so I don't know. It's gonna take a little bit of a hit. It's probably just temporary. We'll come back, but we're doing very well. So September was a great month, and this month is off like gangbusters. We did it wasn't so much funny as it was morbid, but with a point about the ambassador in Libya. The Libyan government finally released his autopsy, and nobody else reported this, of course, except Dub Progressive, and they found that he was, since he was attacked by the practitioners of the religion of peace, he actually died from an overdose of peace, Tom. So that was the official overdose of peace. He was peaced to death. So
oh my goodness!
That's on Dub Progressive, and Obama, he called criticism, after the debate, he called Romney's criticism of his record below the belt. That's done very well. And,
yeah, I saw that.
And we have a poll out today, or a poll out on Monday. And despite what the surge of Romney in the polls after the debates, we found NBC did a poll where the president is leading by 480%, Tom, a shocking, of course, true number, not manipulated at all. And it's standard, according to MSNBC in the article, standard operating procedure to poll 1,100 registered Democrats to only 9 Republicans. So,
wow. Goodness
yeah.
gracious.
480%.
That is scary.
I know. I how can Romney overcome that? I just don't see
it.
I just don't see it. I don't know.
Well,
anyway, I got a running bet with a guy. Who's going to win?
Yeah, okay. Well, just since you mentioned that, I actually had pulled up here, and I was going to bring it up as some news just came out today, that the IBD tip poll, which they claim to be the most accurate pollster in America, has Romney up by 5 points in the country. Now, let's talk for a minute about the debate moving forward. I don't think any debate has ever had this much effect on the polls. And, you know, we've talked about before, poll schmolls, big freaking deal. Because there's way too much water carrying by the media. But still, I find it almost shocking, but I'm delighted that the polls have moved that much in, you know, about a week here from a debate. And everybody prior to the debate, the pundits, they are so smart. They know, oh, it's not going to change much. Oh, you can't change much just from a debate. Well, it certainly did. It really illuminated a couple of things. One, a lot of people just didn't know much about Romney, and that's what I found in the past. And you and I have talked about that many times. Too many people don't get engaged in a very important election, and then, you know, they don't really know who to vote for, and it's kind of from just being stupid. But obviously people got more engaged, paid attention, and then they saw what is so ironic, this empty chair. You know, isn't it so hilarious that Clint Eastwood put that stool up there and did an empty chair bit, and now this empty chair thing going on, I mean, just watching the debate, that's probably the best way to describe Obama. He was an empty chair sitting there.
Well, I have one of my theories is that maybe deep down inside, Obama does not want to win re-election. Because although he is an ideologue and he wants to change America, he wants to change the world, you know, he wants to fundamentally change us all, he is also a narcissist. And being a narcissist, you cannot, there's only so much personal attacks and criticism and pressure that you can be under before you basically back away. This is too much.
Yep.
I can't, you know, put myself out there like this. Some people, you know, they can take the heat like Bill Clinton or any other, you know, Bush, you know, you name it. But there's maybe deep down inside, and this is more of a wishful thinking than it is just a gut feeling, maybe Obama doesn't want to win. You know, he can't take the constant the haranguing and the criticisms and the pressure. He this is an academic. This is a man who was raised by professors. He wasn't.
Yeah.
He spent his life in schools and universities and all that. He's an academic by nature. You take somebody from the faculty lounge, from the ivory towers of Harvard and all that, and you put them on the rough road of reality. This is what you got. This is what you got. You take idealism and you slam it up against the hard brick wall of reality, and you have the presidency of Barack Obama.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Maybe he doesn't want another shot, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right. I have my own theory, and I like yours, though, because that does more damage to him in the long run if his heart's not in it. But he made several comments before the debate, during debate prep, that kind of got out into the media, where he talked to the media a little bit. And he made it clear he doesn't like having to get ready for a debate. You know, it's too much. He didn't say this, but my read is it's work. He doesn't like to work. We know that he's the laziest president that we've had in probably at least the last 70, 80 years, and he just doesn't like having to do the work. I mean, it's below him to have to prep to do a debate, and then show up in the debate. That's blowing. What he was built for, what works for him, is reading off a teleprompter to all of his minions and feeling their applause and their and how much they like him and all that kind of stuff. He's the king who really doesn't care if anybody likes him or not. Just tell everybody to get out there in the square, the town square, and clap and applaud, and then go home. Otherwise, there will be beatings and hangings. So he doesn't like putting in the work. He's lazy. We know that for a fact. And second of all, he can't speak from the heart. If he spoke from the heart about what he really felt about things, the only way he'd win a debate was if it was held at the local Communist Party town hall. Or, you know, he's talking in front of a group of his hardcore leftist, you know, followers. That's it. So I think, that's really a big part of his problem. Can't talk from the heart and really doesn't like putting in the effort to get ready. But now we've got another guest coming on, somebody that you lined up for us, and I'm gonna bring him on here, but I'm going to introduce him as we bring him on. His name is Matt Brainerd, and he's originally from Georgetown, South Carolina, and a graduate of George Washington University. He's worked through three election cycles as the Republican National Committee as a political consultant analyst, and he's also worked for pollster Frank Luntz as an analyst. He's an Ironman triathlete, trained in Muay Thai in Thailand. I don't know what that means. He'll have to tell us. Has an advanced open water diving certificate and is an award-winning short fiction writer. He's the president of Brainerd Group Incorporated, which provides services in voter targeting, polling, fundraising, and web development. So with all the polls and what's been going on, welcome aboard, Matt, and tell us your thoughts on what's transpired here in the last few weeks.
Yeah, hey, how are you guys doing? I'm glad to be here.
We're great.
Now, if people want to connect with you and find out more about what you're up to and follow you on social media or website, where can they connect with you?
Well, they're welcome to friend me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. Every day I try to write a 100-word note on whatever's going on that day or whatever moves my dial. So they're free to follow me there. I'm not so big on Twitter. I am on app.net, but almost nobody else is there. So I'd say just find me on Facebook. It's M-A-T-T, Brainerd, B as in Bravo, R-A-Y, and as in November, A-R-D as in Delta.
Okay. Well, listen, before we move on, there's one thing I forgot to do administratively. We got to do a shout-out to Joan Flowers. She's listening tonight, and we've been working now for a couple years to try and get her father, who's a World War II hero buried in an unmarked grave in Chicago, to Arlington. It's been a tough road. One of the things that she's had a very difficult time with is getting anybody in this administration to give her the time of day. One of her senators in Illinois is Little Dick Durbin, and his office won't do anything with her. Her congresswoman, what's her name, Mary, begins with an S-H, something like that, whatever it is. Yeah, she's a creep, too, and tries passing her off. And so this is something where we've had a hard time. I've worked with the VA to see if there's a way that we can just, you know, take care of it. And there is a way to get him there in an urn versus in a grave site, but the money isn't there for exhuming him and shipping him down to Arlington. Now, she was promised by, get this, Bill Clinton, that it would all be done back when Clinton was president, and it didn't get done. And so she's been fighting for this for many, many years, and we're going to keep fighting. I told her the other day on Twitter, I said, well, in less than 30 days, we're going to have a new administration that actually cares about this kind of stuff, that actually cares about veterans, and I bet we can get somebody's ear in this new administration and get this taken care of. So just want to put that out there. We'll have Joan back on the show one of these days to talk about it, especially when we make some more headway. But I needed to put that out there. Now, Matt.
And I'm sorry to hear about your friend Joan there, but I tell you what I do to help. I own a shovel, and there's a metro stop down there at the Arlington Cemetery. So if you guys wanted to join me, we'll just get it done. Get it done an old-fashioned way. It's a volunteer effort.
Okay.
We're conservative. Yeah, we believe in individuals taking responsibility and getting the job done. We'll find a nice place down there.
Yeah, we can do
and
that.
And with my construction background, I know how to operate like one of those little mini Hitachi backhoes. We could just dig a
crack. There you go, man.
We'll just
roll in there, man, and get it done.
Okay.
Yeah. Nobody will know.
At some point, we're going to have to do a fundraiser for
flying them out there and all that kind of stuff. But we'll get it done one of these days, absolutely. But just to listen to the stories of what she's been up against fighting with bureaucracy for a guy that absolutely deserves to be buried in Arlington is just shameful, absolutely shameful. But now, one of the things I noticed in your bio there, Matt, is that you have worked with Frank Luntz, and I just saw him the other day predicting that Obama's going to win this race. What's up with that?
Well, Frank has always been a pessimistic fellow, and it's just sort of his dour mood. You know, some people like to have low expectations, so when things don't go their way, they're not terribly disappointed. And the upside of that is he's probably going to be elated the evening of November 6th. But yeah, he's actually gotten a really good record in historically of prognosticating, but you know, things can change, and I really. I'd like to see what his answer is going to be maybe a week out from the election, because between now and then, anything can happen. And, you know, just a week or two ago, Republicans were starting to hit the panic button. People were freaking out. It was like a 9-1 odd on in-trade. But I think some patience is required here. And as we saw at the last debate, there's reason to have hope. And we see some of the numbers coming out these last few days. They're turning our way. We're starting to see a lot of you know, plus one, plus two, plus five Romney on national polls, and I'll trickle down to state polls. And, you know, a lot of the money that's been packed away and raised by the super PACs, by the campaign itself, by the victory committee, that hasn't been spent yet. And once they turn that on, we see how quickly these polls can turn. I mean, you may remember after South Carolina, it looked like, to some people, we were going to have Newt Gingrich as our nominee. He was up by 30 points in Florida. But then the air war began. And people started to, you know, we really turned up the effort, and the time to turn up the effort is going to be in these next couple of weeks. I mean, I've started getting direct mail pieces where I haven't been getting them before. And so the pressure is on now to hit these last few, I don't think so much of them, but these very important undecided voters, and they're really going to be targeted now, and they're really going to start hearing the message on these big ad buys. So I haven't spoke to Frank lately. He's kind of – he does the consulting for the – I think it's Fox News still, but in a lot of ways he's kind of checked out. He's got a nice house in Los Angeles. He doesn't do any political clients anymore. He maybe does some private consulting. But, I think he's wrong.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, just in the state of Florida here, we've had a huge upsurge since the debate of new registered voters, most of which have been Republicans. So suddenly the Republican get-out-the-vote effort is really kicking in the gear and getting a lot of new registered Republican voters.
You'll see also, you know, a big part of this is a lot, you know, the focus is on November 6th, but a lot of states, including my state and other South Carolina, a lot of other places around the country, people are voting now. And I think that, you know, here's the thing. A lot of the enthusiasm in the public, or the way the vote is sort of shifted towards Romney's favor after this last debate, that gradually dissipates. But I can't think of a better way to open up the early voting season than with that last debate performance. So I think I think the timing of that was just right.
Okay, awesome. Now, who did you originally support in the GOP primary? Who would you have liked to have seen be the nominee?
Oh, even going back to 2008, I was in the Romney camp. I've actually been pretty enthusiastic about him. I get the feeling that a lot of Republicans kind of looked at him the way, if you see the movie Braveheart, at the end of the film, they're all getting ready to surrender to Longshanks, and they're not happy because they wanted William Wallace to be leading them, but instead they've got Robert the Bruce out there. And at the end, Bruce tells him, you know, I know I'm not the guy you want to go into battle with, but will you fight for me for all the causes that are important for us? And they rally together, and they cheer, and they go on and fight like warrior poets, as Mel Gibson put it. I get the sense that that's the way that a lot of voters had initially looked at Mitt Romney is, oh, okay, fine, I guess so. I've always known the kind of guy that he is, and the public has never really quite gotten to see it. They caught a glimpse of it during the debates in the primary season, which is why most of them voted for him. But it wasn't until just recently you're getting, you know, the true unfiltered Romney. I think he really has the potential to be arguably the most conservative and successful president at least in the modern era. He has everything behind him that will give him those kinds of capabilities. I've always been pretty enthusiastic about him. I was on the Romney, on the bandwagon with him as early as, I think, 2007 last time around. And, you know, face it, this time around, you know, we got led around by the nose by a bunch of charlatans like Herman Cain and, Newt Gingrich and a lot of other guys who were just in there for a payday. Sarah Palin was teasing people around. But, this time around, honestly, I didn't think we even had much of a choice about it. Like last time in 2008, we had a few quality candidates. But this time around, he was really the only legitimate, truly legitimate candidate who had his act together. So, you know, I'm very happy with this choice. We didn't have a whole lot of other options. We just didn't have a lot of other options beside him this time around.
Yeah. Can I interject?
Yeah, jump in there, Nick.
Compared to 2008, this campaign that's going on now with Romney Ryan makes it makes McCain Palin look like an episode of Romper Room. It really does. Sarah Palin definitely has her place. I'm glad she's on her side. She's a valuable.
It's in Alaska, by the way. That's where her place is. But go ahead.
Okay. This campaign operates like a very, very well-oiled machine compared to 2008. I went down to Norfolk, which was a battleground area of a purple state, Norfolk and Virginia Beach. You know, if that went one way, then the whole state could have gone one way. And the scene that I saw down there with how they were organized, McCain Palin were organizing down there, I wanted to shoot myself. I really did. No, I shoot them first and then me. But I couldn't believe it. Everyone was just sitting in the office talking about how bad Obama was. Not making calls, not putting out signs. Now, I mean, there was some of that, but mainly it was just a huge sewing circle going on down there. And
it's a top-down thing. I mean, it started with McCain, and it trickled down. It starts with the candidate. He is not a well-organized guy. He's not a guy who does his homework. He's a guy who just, does minimal debate prep, and it's just you can tell. It's from the candidate, and it trickles down. You see the difference. You could tell this was run by a guy who was very successful in the private sector, turning around failed operations. You feel it on every level of the campaign.
You know, and when you mentioned that, there was something that really stood out to me in the debate, and I don't know how many people noticed it, but when the president kept pushing Romney for specifics, well, what about the specifics? First of all, this president's never put out specifics about anything. When it comes to the economy, he uses the term headwinds all the time. Oh, we've got a bunch of headwinds, we're facing, and that's a real technical term, and then bumps in the road, so he's so technical himself. But the way you work with a variety of groups within an organization, I'm talking now about Washington and Congress and the Senate, is just what Romney said. You've got to try and build some kind of consensus. If I walk in there with a plan, a detailed plan, I already know what I want to achieve, and I've explained that. But if I walk in with a detailed plan and say it's my way or the highway, and you looked over at Obama, which is kind of the way Obama's done, although Obama's never written any bill in his life and even close to it, but that's the way it is. This is it. You're going to do this. Whereas a consensus builder comes in and says, here are my goals. Can you guys craft something that achieves these goals? And then when the Congress does craft something, it may not be exactly what you wanted, but at least everybody's got buy-in to it. When I used to do my consulting job, I walked into various organizations knowing what they needed. I knew what their problem was, but if I walked in and said, this is what you must do to fix them, it would never happen. But if I got them and drew out of them what needed to be fixed and their ideas, then they all had buy-in and they got it done. And this is the sign of a leader and, obvious, as you just said, Matt, somebody who has the experience of fixing broken things and fixing companies. He understands that you've got to have everybody's buy-in into this, otherwise you'll never fix anything, whereas Obama's a my way or the highway kind of guy.
Yeah, and I agree. Although I do disagree in one way. I mean, Romney did put together, I think, like a 72-point plan for addressing the economy, and I think there's a lot of good stuff in there. And I think in as much as you can put together detailed white papers and, his 5-point strategy, I find that specific enough. And honestly, If you come in with anything much more specific than that, it just completely tunes the voter out. I mean,
Absolutely. Nick,
we're all high-information voters, but if you try and lay out the equivalent of Obamacare with thousands of pages in front of a live television audience, you know, they're going to be flipping over to Nickelodeon.
Absolutely. So you're right. You're absolutely right. I agree with that, that you can't, you've got to keep it sort of a conceptual for the folks, but that's what Obama understands, and so that's why he'll push Romney, well, give us details, so that they have something to pick apart, and any details that Romney would have are always going to be, I mean, not all of them, but are certainly going to be subject to not only discussion, but, you know, bartering to get the stuff done. Now, you can only go so far with that, but you're absolutely right. The voters don't want to hear that, and a real leader is going to get something done, like Reagan did with Tip O'Neill. Tip didn't like Reagan a whole lot, and Reagan didn't like Tip a whole lot, but they understood they had to work together to get things done, and they did.
That's the one part, and you hear every candidate who comes to D.C., they say that, or they plan to, they're going to reach across the aisle. Mitt talks about his, you know, majority Democrat legislature in Massachusetts. You heard Bush, W, talking about it in Texas. And, you know, you heard Obama. They all talk about that, but I really roll my eyes because here's the thing. November 7th is the day that the Democrats will do everything in their power to defeat Romney. And you know what? Honestly, the day after Obama was elected, that's the day the campaign began to defeat Obama. And it's like, I know that out in the states, you can get away with some true bipartisanship. And, you know, the closer you get to the voters in terms of where the ballots, you know, city council, state legislature, even, you know, up to governorship, partisanship, the polarity, the magnetic polarity of left and right, Democrat, Republican, is not that hard. But in D.C., it is an absolute zero-sum game. So, you know, when he says, I'll work across the aisle, I know the dial goes up. And I know the independent, undecided voters find that appealing. But either it's absolute naivety on their part, or they're just saying it because they know that's what certain people like to hear. But there is, you know, it is blood sport. I mean, I believe if they could get away with it, they would be pulling guns on each other in the street in D.C. and shooting each other. I have no doubt they would devolve to that if they could get away with it, but they can't. So they, you know, it's absolute. They will do absolutely anything to destroy the person of the other party. And Crook, I don't agree with Paul Krugman, but he wrote a really good article explaining why it's not possible. I mean, there is a sharp ideological divide, a stark divide, and there's no bridging it. There's almost no bridging it between, you know, the left and right in this country. We can't find common ground because there is no common ground.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was actually referring just to the Republican Party. I see so many schmucks in Congress that are called Republicans that, you know, just within our own party, we can't reach consensus. So that's kind of really what I was thinking about when I said that.
Can you name a few? I'm just wondering who you have in mind.
John Boehner.
Because they're all listening to this program, but go ahead.
Yeah, they are. They're all listening. I give you an example. You know, when this Congress was elected and, you know, all the euphoria was there, we had two congressmen, a congressman and a congresswoman, propose across-the-board cuts, but nothing to military or national or homeland security, national security. One was a 5% across-the-board cut. One was a 5.5%. They couldn't even get a consensus with the Republicans. They couldn't even get enough Republicans to vote on it, yes, to actually pass the bill just from a Republican standpoint. So I have very deep concerns about the Republican Party and the lack of will to get the necessary things done. I know for a fact that in Canada a few years back, they did a 10% across-the-board cut to their equivalent of the federal government. They didn't have any problem getting that through. I mean, obviously there was debate and other things, but I just don't know the will of the Republican Party. I think I could be surprised, and I hope that I'm pleasantly surprised, but I think Romney, even with a majority in the House and the Senate, is still going to have his work cut out for him just to get the Republican Party on board with making some tough choices.
Yeah, it's always tough. And I was a little bit disappointed in President Bush when he was elected because he came in, he had both houses, and I thought that there should have been some kind of meta council where you kind of pull together all the decision makers at the top and you work collectively as a group rather than basically seeing we're the White House, they're the Senate, they're the House. We're going to operate as units, separate units, rather than having some kind of cooperative effort, you know, that works across the top. But I mean, you know, people are people, and they send the craziest folks to Congress with the craziest ideas, and, you know, you just got to, I guess you just got to make the most of what you got. And so I, even if he isn't elected, I'm going to still be cutting Romney a lot of slack. And you know, that, sadly, I mean, that's democracy. So it's just,
yeah,
it's almost inescapable.
Yeah, I agree. I see some people like John Boehner that I don't think he sees Obamacare as that bad a deal. He'll talk about it as, oh, it's bad because that's what the majority of Americans feel about it. But honestly, if he had his way, I think he loves the power it would give him.
I don't know. I've known Boehner a long time, and I first met him back in, I think it was 96 or so. I would he's in a tough position. That is a rowdy caucus. I mean, we look at the Republican Party and we kind of see it as being this, idealize it as being this Tea Party extension. But he's got a lot of those members in some really tough seats who are just not as conservative as we are. And man, leadership is tough. And you know, I understand why he makes a lot of the decisions he does, and I'm willing to be patient with him. I have not seen him do anything that has made me lose trust in him. But, you know, I hear where you're coming from, and I understand that there's a large segment of the party who really wants more red meat, or to borrow a phrase from Mitt, you know, people to light their hair on fire. But, you know, especially when you face the fact that, you know, he can pass all kinds of wonderful legislation, but then it's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to pass the Senate. The president's not going to sign it. So do you want to pass a piece of legislation that makes more of your members vulnerable but satisfies a small part of the base? And again, he's got, you know, he has to reconcile the fact that there's a large part of the base that really does want some real red meat. And, you know, I have no doubt that he's opposed to Obamacare and will want to get rid of it if he had the chance. So I have to disagree with you on that. But his options are just really limited. And, you know, the House passed several repeals of it. You saw it happen. It was good for getting people, Democrats on the record, especially some of the new ones who were elected in 10. But, I kind of see their hands as tied. At best, he's just running out the clock on the Obama administration, stopping them from doing things they'd like to do.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, and my wife asked me this question the other night. I had an answer, but I want to see what your answer is. What if, you know, we keep the House, Republicans keep the House, Mitt Romney's elected, but we don't take the Senate, and Harry Reid's there to stonewall legislation? What can Mitt Romney do to stop Harry Reid doing what he's been doing for the last 2 years?
I guess it depends in part on what the margin is, because there are a couple of Democrats you may be able to get across the aisle to get some kind of, at least in budgetary matters, you just need a 50% that can't filibuster it. But, and there's also, arguably, there's a little bit of a grace period because with Bush, you know, they needed, I think, 60, or they needed to break a few filibusters to get through some of his honeymoon legislation. But you're asking me what can Mitt do? What Mitt can do is look to the 2014 election and getting the additional seats he needs, and starting to do really good candidate recruitment in the races where there are vulnerable Democrats in 14. I mean, the answer to so many of these questions, how do you get the legislation through, or how do you achieve various legislative goals or policy goals, is you campaign to defeat the people who are holding them up. And the simple answer is, hey, there are no easy answers. He's going to have a really hard time.
Yeah. Now, what can he do in the public forum, with the bully pulpit, in terms of pointing out that the House is passing bills and Harry Reid's sitting on them, not even letting him go to committee? I mean, can he shame Harry Reid into, you know, capitulating and letting some votes happen? Remember, it was Obama, when it came to Obamacare, and he was really pushing, trying to get it passed. He said, look, I just want a simple up or down, a simple up or down. Can't you say to Harry Reid, remember the simple up or down concept? Obama just wanted a simple up or down. Start giving us some simple up or downs. Are you guys hypocrites? Well, we know they are. But, I mean, do you think the court of public opinion could shame him a little bit into pulling back?
But you assume that Harry Reid has shame.
Well, no, yeah, I know. Yeah. His kids.
I don't think Mr. You know, the war is lost has any shame left, and neither do the Democrats who support him and keep him ensconced in the majority leadership position. And, you know, even if we get 50-51 in the Senate, they're still going to have substantial stopping power. So some of the model, I guess you just have to look to, is a combination of how did Bush get through things he needed to get through, And it's just going to be the beginning of a 2-year campaign to get rid of more Democrats in the Senate and make that the focus. Here's the thing. Bush was able to achieve a lot, even though there was a Democrat majority, or at sometimes a 40 plus always 40 plus to filibuster. The way they usually got things through was by finding the one place they could all agree on, which was just to spend more money to increase the deficit. So yeah. Usually that was deficit spending was the lubricant on a lot of Bush initiatives. But I know that that is not going to be the way that Romney is going to pursue it. It's just not going to happen, and the public is not going to put up with it. And the Republicans in the House are absolutely not going to put up with that, and the base and donors are not going to put up with that. So that lubricant that used to be there was basically to spend more. You know, you're not happy with this legislation, but would you vote for it if we threw a few hundred billion at this pet project of yours? And suddenly that moves things through, so a vote can happen, an up and down vote. You pass something by 51. That's not going to be there anymore. So I think that you're probably looking at another 2 years of really horrible gridlock, regardless of who wins. But even if Mitt wins, you know, if we get 51 plus, that helps a lot with budget stuff. We can defund Obamacare and advance a few things, and you know, get our Supreme Court justices on. But you know, it's. And you know, it's just reflective of the country, because Mitt's not going to win by 60% or 65%. He's going to win. He's maybe going to get 52, 53. So the inability to get anything Washington done is reflective. You know, you see bad children who don't listen, who can't behave, who don't follow instructions and act up in school. Well, they're just reflective of the parents and the environment they grew up in. In the same way, the politicians here, they're just reflective of the voters who send them here, extremely divided, often holding contradictory ideas at the same time that they can, you know, have less government spending, lower taxes, but also free health care. You know, it's just reflective of that kind of psychosis that's endemic to the voter base as a whole.
Yeah. Matt, you're preaching to the choir, being me, because, you know, it's. We say, oh, they don't really represent us, or they get up on Capitol Hill, and then they, you know, they turn around, they betray us, and all that. And it's really just like anything else. You get what you pay for. When people complain that Washington's divided, oh, I just want them to come together. Well, you can't even come together with your neighbor. Okay, your neighbor puts out a Romney sign, you throw feces on it. Or your neighbor puts out an Obama 2012 sign, the next day it's gone. You know, we can't even come together like that. So you send these people up there who are reflective of the people who elect them. Sometimes like with Boehner, by not that great a margin. So he really has to watch, you know, how he handles himself up on, you know, in the speaker's position on Capitol Hill. And it's really reflective of the way that the country is. The country is, honest to God, divided. You have one group of people who sees this grant, who have this murky notion that we can all come together, and that the Donald Trumps and the Mitt Romneys, you know, they have to be punished and dumbed down, and a lot more of their money has to be taken away, stolen, if you will, and people deserve Obama.
I prefer the term liberated, but go ahead.
Liberté, yes. Yes, it could be another French Revolution. Also, Romney, Harry Reid's a fellow Mormon. Why can't he reach out to him that way? You know,
Reid has been bad mouthing Romney's religion, in that saying that Romney betrays the values of Mormonism. He's been calling Mitt a bad Mormon, and it's just. Harry, there's no low, whether it comes to lying about not paying taxes for 10 years, to just making stuff up. It, you know, there's Harry Reid there's a special place in hell for him where he's going. And until he gets there, we just have to deal with him. And, you know, the fact that they would elect him their leader. Not a moderate guy, not a decent guy willing to work across the aisle, but this raspy voice. Crook who's become a multimillionaire as he's been serving in the Senate. Would you really want a president who would be willing to work across the aisle with a Harry Reid? Or, I mean, would sell his soul to cross the aisle to deal with that? Look, these guys, you just got to defeat them. And we really screwed it up last time because we had a great chance to take him out, and we picked a horrible candidate, and she lost, and we're stuck with him for at least, another 4 years, and hopefully we'll have learned our lesson and put up a decent opponent for him next time.
Or yeah. I know how Romney could get rid of Reid. One more idea. Trick him into making an anti-Muhammad video and then have him arrested. You can always pull that card, you know.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well,
because, you know, that's not too kosher, and I don't use kosher lightly.
Yeah, man.
Well, how do you think the tomorrow's big show is going to go down? Ryan Biden.
You see, well, I know that Biden's being prepped, and I think that they are going. I think it's going to be a little bit like the last debate in that Biden is going to have he's going to be working almost strictly from a script, and the benefit of the script is that if he stays on script, he doesn't risk saying anything colossal, you know, stupid or having a gaffe as he has had so many. I was about to say recent history, but going all the way back to the 80s when he first ran for president and lied about his college record. So he's going to be really dialed down, and he knows his weaknesses, so he's going to stay very strictly to his script. The downside is, though, that you can't improvise. So what's going to happen is Ryan is going to be Ryan, which is just a phenomenal debater, ready to go, and he'll be able to improvise and throw attacks and counterpunches that Biden will not have had anticipated in his script. So what Ryan's going to try to do, I'm going to guess, is try to lure Biden to go off script. And we all know what happens when Biden goes off script. You know, people start being put into chains, and other ridiculous statements come out of his mouth. And the thing is, vice presidents, you know, it's all canard. They're not going to lose you. They're not going to win you the election, but they can certainly lose it for you. So Ryan's goal is going to be to draw the real Biden out and, potentially just make him completely unacceptable as a vice presidential candidate, no matter what's going on at the top of the ticket. Or Biden's going to just have to be so cautious that Ryan's going to be able to run the field and say whatever he wants and not be responsible. Well, it's funny, this debate is really going to kind of put things on the other shoe for where they were for me these last several elections, because I know you guys watched the debates in 92, 96, 2000, 2004, 2008. And especially with W and to some extent his dad, and especially with Dole, whenever it was like debate night, I would get this tension in the middle of my stomach. I would get really nervous, and I'd watch the debate just with a cold sweat trickling down my neck, sort of like watching a drunk do a high wire act. Because I just knew that there was a huge chance that our guy was going to screw up and do something stupid. What's telling to me is that last Wednesday, when I watched the Romney debate, I didn't feel that at all. I knew what this was going to be, and I knew this guy had it. And again, I feel this way with Ryan. But how I used to feel watching W go into a debate is how I imagine those Democrats have gotten to be feeling watching Biden. I mean, can you just imagine what it is like being a dyed-in-the-wool left-wing Democrat in your mind thinking about how this debate is going down? Can you imagine how nervous these people must be?
Oh yeah, absolutely. it could be a comedy hour for us.
It could.
I know,
unless Biden pulls out the foreign policy, unless you know that's something that Ryan is not that familiar with. That's not his bread and butter.
I think that Biden's been Biden foreign policy. Let's consider first of all his plan for Iraq was to cut it into three different countries. That was his foreign
mm-hmm.
policy recommendation on Iraq. His foreign policy recommendation on bin Laden was not to go in. You may recall from in the stories that followed bin Laden's death, Biden was the one who counseled the president not to do it. Biden, in his foreign policy description, this is the problem with having a Sarah Palin, who was also extremely scripted, is when Biden was talking about the French going in to liberate Libya, this fantasy alternate world where stuff happened in that world, which did not happen in reality. I don't know where Biden was getting it, what he had been smoking that had led him to discuss this in that vice presidential debate. Like, Palin wasn't able to call on it because she had no idea. But, you know, Biden is here's the thing. Vice presidents have been used for have had different roles: close advisor, playing a leadership role, being in charge of certain things, had things delegated to them, whether it was Gore with reducing paperwork in government, or Cheney was basically, I think, the proxy president, various roles that they've held. I've never before seen the presidential role used for comic relief. And that's something that Biden has pioneered. And I think that, it's going to be a disaster. And I think they're just buckling down. They were building up, they've tried to avoid talking about it, but I found in the press, nobody's out there saying, oh yeah, you better watch out for Biden. It's going to be a really great night for us Democrats. I haven't heard that anywhere, and it's telling.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's so much stuff you can pull out on Biden. Remember, he was assigned by the president, before the president even raised his hand to take the oath, to preside over, improving the station of the middle class. And then the other day, what does he say? That the middle class has been, just brutalized over the last 4 years. That wasn't a very good statement. But then who's the guy that was really supposed to be paying close attention for the president to that and coming up with ways and working with the Congress to come up with ways to improve things for the middle class? Biden. So the question is, so what have you done, Mr. Biden, or Vice President Biden, to do that? You were assigned that task by the president. What have you actually done? He can't say anything. He's not going to. You're right. If he has to go off script, he's not going to know what to say, and he is going to stick his foot right in his mouth. And so I'm going to be watching that with a big bucket of popcorn and a big Coke and soda pop, ready to go, because it's going to be like a good movie at the movie theater.
Yeah, I can't. The pick of Biden was just incomprehensible to me. You remember in 2008, he ran for president, and he ended his campaign on the same day he started it, when somebody asked him what he thought of Barack Obama, and he said, "Oh yeah, it's nice to have a clean, articulate black guy running for president." That was the first day of his presidential campaign. As somebody else was talking about, I heard elsewhere that he has not done a sit down interview in the last 5 months. During this time, Paul Ryan, I think, has done 150 of them. I mean, they've been hiding this guy out. If he was all that articulate, they'd be throwing him out to do press availabilities. He'd do town halls, anything. But they basically kind of, he's like the crazy uncle they don't want to talk about. And that crazy uncle is going to be center stage on prime time on every network and every cable news channel tomorrow night. And, the expectations for Biden are so low right now. I think the White House is going to take a breath of relief if he just doesn't soil himself on stage. That's where the bar is right now.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right about that. They lowered the bar for the president, too, before, saying like, oh, well, Romney's a really good debater, and he's had more time to prep. And so they're absolutely going to lower the bar. And unfortunately for the president, they didn't lower it enough. So
yeah, I mean, he's the freaking president. He shouldn't be losing a debate to anybody. Come on. He's supposed to be a genius. And they built him up so high the last time around. And, I'll tell you something else. I don't think that he actually did that badly in the debate compared to 2008. I actually watched the videos of both of them. I watched the closing statements. He was a little bit off, a little bit more halting. But once he got warmed up, he was about the same he was in 2008. The difference was that in 2008, he was debating a guy who graduated absolute last in his class at the Naval Academy. This time, he was debating a guy who graduated from Harvard Business School magna cum laude and Harvard Law School summa cum laude. And this is the difference the candidate makes, because, it was about the same guy, but you put him up against, I always believed that Romney, I believe the campaigns won and lost on the fundamentals. Romney got his fundamentals down. He did his homework. He was prepared. He did at least 10 mock debates and probably full dress with his suit and tie on and it just, under lights, and he was ready to go. And that's really the difference here. We've got what I've always believed to be a phenomenal candidate. And finally, people are beginning to know it. You remember during the primary, they say, oh, Romney can't debate Obama because he passed the same health care plan in his state. That was the chorus from people like Santorum and Gingrich. Well, you see how he did that very effectively this time around. And I'm not above saying I told you so.
Yeah, well, that was pretty awesome. He did a good job with that. Well, as we wrap things up, Nick, what's coming up at Duff Progressive, and what's going on that people ought to know about?
What? I'm on the show?
Yeah, yeah. Wake up, Nick.
Welcoming Nick of the Progressives. Tell us about your website, Nick. What you doing over there?
Yeah, what's going on?
He's working on
his website right now.
Yeah. I was just letting you all go at it. I was like, damn, man. I knew Matt would be a good guest, but as I adjust my imaginary tie. On Dub Progressive, right now we got the story running about the president's 480. I know we all want to talk about polls, but our poll at Dub Progressive found that the President Obama is leading Mitt Romney by 480%, a stunning amount. And I don't know how Romney's going to get
sounds
over
reasonable.
It. Also, NBC took it. That's how you know it's reliable.
Well, they're the gold standard, right?
Yeah. You know, of course, it's completely, it's completely legit to interview 1,100, what is the number, 1,120 Republicans for every 9 Democrats that they do. Also, we have if you go to commentary on duhprogressive.com, you go to commentary, we have a very upset young lady. She is a senior sociology major, which means her future is oh so bright after graduation. She goes to Columbia University. Her name is Flower McMillan. She's very upset. She says, she wrote in just to us, just Dub Progressive. She wrote in saying, how will America look if we don't reelect Barack Obama at least 4 more times? You know, we have all this racist history and, you know, your first guest, you know, Eric Rush, who's, you know, the whole concept was about race and his book Negrophilia and putting them up on pedestals and all that. And, for our first black president, we have to elect him not just twice, but we have to amend the Constitution so that he can be president at least until 20. Actually, he would be leaving office 2029. So she's very upset about that, and she's begging people not to just vote for Obama again this year, but to pass that constitutional amendment and so we can vote for him 3 more times after that. And then we can consider ourselves no longer a racist country. It's and she knows her history too. You know, she says a vote for Barack. If you don't vote for Barack Obama 4 more times, we might as well be back in the Russell Crowe era in the Deep South. So she definitely knows her history.
Yeah. Gracious. And you know, maybe with honestly, if we gave the president that many more terms, he might actually be able to get something done.
I don't want him to get any more. I don't want him to get any more.
Yeah, think about how many more ambassadors he could get killed if he had those many more terms.
Yeah, exactly. Probably all of them. Probably all of them.
Yeah.
Well,
they should send one. I mean,
yeah, they should send Mila Kunis over there to replace him. I heard she's very fond of Republicans and Christians. She'll feel right at home over there around all the radical Muslims.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Matt, one more time, tell us about your Facebook page and anything else you want people to know about that you're doing out there that people should know about.
Man, that sure is crummy when your guest doesn't even have a URL to give out or even a Twitter handle. I really should get my act together. Actually, this month I will be launching the dailymatt.com, and I'll have my commentary 100 words only so as not to waste your time. Posted daily, but right now I've written like 800 of them, and I've just posted them to Facebook. So you know, send me a friend request, Matt Brainerd, and be happy to welcome you in. And just stay tuned. We'll get the dailymatt.com up. I think hopefully before the election.
Awesome.
Because they don't have a week to be on the internet before if elected Obama shuts it down and puts all of us in prison in Gitmo. So, I look forward to spending some time with you guys down in Cuba. I've been working on my volleyball skills, and I'm coming for you, Nick. You better watch. I got a wicked serve.
Good. Okay, great. You know what? It's my type of weather down there in Cuba. You know, as long as I can snorkel once every day and, you know, bring up some spiny lobster to eat, that's fine. And one of the reasons why I didn't mention your name I don't know what Tom did, but at least when I promoted the show is because I asked you, can I use your name, and you never got back to me, and I don't want to use someone's name in promoting the show unless they say yes. So
Sorry. I thought I said that was okay. You're welcome to use my name anytime because my credit's horrible and there's not much worse you can do with it. But just stay out of the nice restaurants that I like to go to, and you can use it anywhere you like. Although there's nothing wrong with your name, even though I can't pronounce your last name. Brainerd's not much of an improvement, though.
Well, that's why I cut it in half and go by Taxia.
Taxia. Nick. Brainerd, you're definitely welcome. You know, I feel sorry for you now because of the name. So you're more than welcome to use my name now. Please, go ahead.
Okay. This is Nick Brainerd, everybody, saying have a good night.
All right, you guys. Well, listen, we'll see you again next week. Nick, you're going to be back with us next week on Wednesday, same time?
Yep. It comes late. Right. You come on before South Park, so I can tune in.
Awesome. All right, we'll be back next week. We got a good guest, Colonel Jim Harding of the National Spokesman for Veteran Defenders of America. And, of course, we'll have the Nick Taxia segment from theprogressive.com. Thanks for being with us tonight, guys. Matt Brainerd and Nick Taxia. And we'll be back next week, Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern.
Listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.